is that yeah. worth it? No, you, well, you know better than me, so.
I want to see that.
I think it'll be absolutely fine, thanks. It's a DVD we've been working on, it's just around beforehand. It doesn't need to be that loud, it's just music. Just gently in the background so I don't want to listen to it.
Hi Tommy, yeah. How you doing? Not for a moment, not for 5 minutes, but yeah. Okay. How's your number? 653. Neighbor, okay. Okay.
That's looking good. Thanks very much.
Is that okay?
Yeah, absolutely fantastic.
Thank you. That's fine. My name is Tommy, okay, and I'm from Leeds. Just got to get a little shout, okay?
Thanks, sir.
I'll see you soon.
Have a nice evening.
No, I'm not. Thank you. for this international seminar. I'm told it's the 30th in the series of seminars that Andrew Lyon has been organising for the Glasgow Centre for Population Health. Anyone who's been to all 29 up to now is probably much better capable of answering this question even than Maureen, and certainly will provide a safer pair of hands than most in the city or in the country. So I congratulate all those who are here for repeat visits. That includes Maureen, who was last here in 2004 and has come back to Scotland for another session to update us on the story of how to cope with difficult and challenging times. Maureen is a humanistic psychologist, trained in person-centered approaches. She works as the chair of the Department of Psychology at National University in San Diego, California. As she said, she arrived in the UK last Thursday and is adjusted but not acclimatized. She's also the president emerita of Saybrook Graduate School. And from all of that, you may detect that her life's passion is as an educator. The work that she's done over the years has been discovering how people grow and develop, including through difficult times and difficult circumstances, and working as an educator to try and provide the settings and the resources and the conditions in which to help people grow and develop. So that's her abiding passion, and we're very fortunate, I would say, in Scotland and in the International Futures Forum to have been working with Maureen in different contexts over many years. And so although what she will have to say may come across as a very high level of generalization and the global picture, the global story, it is rooted in experience, not only in the US, but also here in Glasgow and in Scotland generally. So I hope in the discussion that will follow what Maureen has to say, we will get down and dirty to really not only answering that question, I'll be up to it, but given that my assumption is that we are up to it, otherwise we wouldn't be here, what would being up to it mean in practice, including in the city of Glasgow? So Maureen, that's a tough brief, but I know you can fulfill it.
No, thank you. What worries me is you said he's here to keep order. And I just wondered, does that mean people in Glasgow are a pretty unruly bunch? Should I be careful? I mean, if we Yorkshire people sort of think of you Glasgow people as a pretty wild bunch, so that kind of worries me a little, Graham. So I'll try not to be too provocative. Anyway, I really appreciate the opportunity to share with you the sort of fruits of some of my thinking over the last couple of decades, particularly got into the question of the big picture. When I started to work with clients in psychotherapy in San Diego who were coming from a lot of different cultural contexts, people from Mexico who were coming from upper class households and Oaxacan Indians who were coming across the border illegally and military people who were living in the military culture and educated university people living in that culture, and gradually began to dawn on me that unless we understood more about what was going on at the bigger picture level, understanding what people were talking about at the micro level of individual lives and individual identities was not making a lot of sense. And so at that point, I started to get very interested in the work that futurists were doing, particularly psychological futurists, who were looking at what were the consequences of some of the trends that we could see in the present, what were the psychological consequences that we could start to predict of what was going on in the world. And so that's the sort of origin of me moving out of strictly focusing on the psychological process that one deals with in psychotherapy to broader and broader questions of human growth and development, and what is it that really does it take to enable people to live well, to thrive, to develop, and to fully realize themselves as people. What does that take? And in particular, what is that going to take as the world changes and the conditions of life become quite different from the conditions of life that our cultures, whichever they are, have prepared us to prepared us for. And I'm following on the ideas of people like Vaclav Havel, who have also observed that we are in such turbulent and powerful times that without a change in consciousness, nothing will change for the better in the sphere of our being as humans, and that the catastrophe towards which we are headed will be unavoidable. And so any of you who read the newspapers and who look at trends and consider the implications, even relatively short-term, let alone long-term, we do appear to be heading towards a catastrophe. And that the a lot of the interventions that are being offered to us really stay within the same rule set of the conditions that we have that have led to what Havel identifies as the impending catastrophe. So I've been trying to look at how could that be avoided? What about this change in consciousness? And the main ideas that I'm going to deal with tonight is that we are not in an era of change, but we're actually in a change of eras, and that we are, in fact, responsible for the planet's future. It's not going to take care of itself. We are way too impactful an influence on the planet now for us to just say, well, let it take care of itself. And that another idea is that incoherence, uncertainty, and anxiety are the new universal context. Nobody's immune from that. Doesn't matter where you live, there is no escape. Cognitive dissonance that we're all living in provokes a pathological response, anxiety, denial, all of those things which we'll talk about, but it also provokes a possibility of a transformational response, that we, in these kind of times, you can have a pathological response and or a transformational response. Another idea is that meaning and psychological coherence are survival necessities. It's not just some kind of middle class frill. To have meaning, to have a sense of coherence, psychological identity and so on, is a necessity, and it's increasingly in short supply. And that the questions to raise the question of what could we do to take more responsibility now for the longer term future of humanity. Now, as I know that this is a organization that's dedicated towards population health, I just wanted to start out with giving you some signs that of the level of the scale of trouble that we appear to be in. There's almost 1 billion people that suffer some kind of serious mental distress. We're not talking about the worried well. We're talking about people who, to some degree or another, are incapacitated by psychological problems. There's 1 million suicides annually, and there's over 20 million attempts annually. And there's a huge increase in India right now, and that we could maybe speculate on what some of that's about. Alcoholism and drug use is up 67% in 15 years. Stress results in 40% of all disability claims in Canada. Violence rates are up in all developed nations. War trauma results in millions with PTSD. Divorce rates are up everywhere. 750,000 Japanese men, the hikikomori, never leave their home. They can't cope. There's a whole class of Japanese mental illness that is hikikomori, which means withdrawn from life. Russian, Japanese, and Italian women are delaying marriage and not having children. So the population drop, and the reason why they give is, I don't have any faith in the future. 30% of African American men will be incarcerated at some time in their life. By 18, the average U.S. child has seen 200,000 acts of violence and witnessed 16,000 murders. 1 in 4 European teens have diagnosable mental illness. Only 18% of 9th graders in the States will graduate from college. Most of them will drop out in despair. Teen-on-teen homicides are increasing every year. 1 in 4 U.S. grade school children uses drugs. Increase in violence in under 7, including the murder of younger siblings because they've seen it on TV. 15 million Brazilian children live on the streets. And worldwide, child soldiers kill and rape and are raped by other child soldiers. And I give you those statistics. I could stand here for another hour and give you statistic after statistic after statistic, and all of them trending in the wrong direction. And as a psychologist, I'm interested in the psychological dimensions of pain and suffering. But you could also put together the psychophysical diseases that go along with these kind of numbers. And on every metric that we want to look at, the direction is, we're in the wrong direction. So the reason I'm interested in this is because I want to us to understand something about the magnitude of the problem, and therefore the scale of what we will have to do to intervene and to reverse it. And it's the kind of layer of statistics that in my profession in psychotherapy, I will say to my graduate students, if you think the solution to this is more individual counseling, you're wrong. That you cannot get there from here. We have to rethink the problem so that we can rethink the solution. So this is essentially the origin of my work. In the early days of the colonialization of the United States, the founders of the College of William and Mary in the States offered to local Indian chiefs 12 positions in their school for their sons. And they said, we would like, as part of this treaty for your land, we will give your kids an education. And the chiefs turned them down. And they said to them, we don't want to send our children to your school. Some of our colleagues from other tribes have already done that. And the children come back ruined. They're good for nothing. They don't know anything. They don't know anything that's useful to us. But if you want your sons to learn how to be men, we can have them come and apprentice with our local tribal teachers. And what the Indians were saying to the colonists is, we understand that education is more than just giving us useful knowledge. That with every educational system comes a way of understanding reality, comes a way of life, and every educational system brings with it its own psychology. And the colonists were offering an education that would suit the children to live in the world that the colonists believed would be the future of America. The tribal leaders said, we don't want our children socialized into that world because that's not the world that they live in. And this, for me, is a sort of an emblematic story of what we're dealing with on a planetary scale at this point. Is that the encounter between ways of life, the encounter between worlds of identity and conceptualization of the world, is going on faster and more furious all the time. And so, I want to introduce you to a new word. It might be new to you. It's the word psychosphere, and I'm using this word to speak about a psychological equivalent of an ecosphere or a biosphere. We all know what an ecosphere is and a biosphere is. Now, 25 years ago, nobody knew what that was. And what I'm trying to define with this word is this holistic, interconnected, joined-up system of narratives, symbols, ways of life, epistemologies, cognitive habits, rituals, things that we take for granted about the way we function psychologically at the level of processing knowledge, at the level of interpersonal habits, at the level of sense of self, at the level of identity, at the level of what we project out into the future. We don't think about this very much, but there is in fact a whole system of interpenetrating meanings that we each inhabit that in fact gives us the sense of what reality is all about. And I'm suggesting that it's useful to think about this as a psychosphere. Ordinarily, in developmental psychology, we teach our students that the psychosphere is made up of the individual microsystem, the interpersonal system, the local neighborhood, and the law and society and big picture systems. We usually diagram it something like this. It looks very organized and very nicely nested one inside the other, as if it's some kind of ordered system. And it's comforting to see it that way, but I want to persuade you is that that's actually not the case anymore. Richard Schwader's just an additional piece of the story is Richard Schwader, who's a cultural psychologist, has identified that for any society to remain relatively stable, the group has to share a common psychosphere. So all of that stuff that I'm talking about has to be more or less shared by the people who inhabit any particular society for it to remain stable. You have to have a pretty good expectation that if I say, "Hi, Andrew," Andrew's not going to take that as an insult. Or if I say, "I'll be there at 9 o'clock, I'll probably will." Or all the other agreements that we take tacitly for granted, that has to be relatively shared, relatively widely shared and stably shared for a society to do okay. And that this psychosphere then both expresses our identity and our psychology, but it also gives us the rules upon which we will reproduce it. So built into any psychology, cultural psychology, is the means of its reproduction. So if we believe that an independent identity is an important part of our psyche, then we will build into our social systems means for our children developing an individual identity. If we believe a collective identity is more desirable, we will build into our socializing systems means for raising children who have a collective identity. So that's what I mean by saying that the psychosphere expresses our psychology, but it also designs systems to reproduce it and keep it going. He also noticed that if the dominant narrative that holds a society together changes in any substantial way, social and psychological distress increases, and at times total societal collapse occurs. And the examples he uses, for example, would be the Amazonian Indians, who in their contact with the miners in the north of Brazil, the conflict, the cultural collision was so brutal that the Guaranami could not survive that, and that their culture totally disintegrated, and that none of the assumptions upon which they had lived their lives mapped onto the new world that was developing as a consequence of the cultural collision. And Schwader found examples of this in many different settings where the grand story of who we are as a people and what we believe in and what we value and what we care about and what we will invest in changes. Not all societies can sustain themselves in the face of that level of change. So to reiterate, cultures produce a way of life. That way of life produces a modal psychology, and that modal society then in turn produces the way of life. Now, there's deeper news than that, because I think so far the story is, well, okay, so what? Different cultures produce different kinds of people. But it's deeper than that, because it creates differences even in brain structure. We can do now scans of brain structures from people who were raised in tribal nomadic societies and people who were raised in industrialized urban societies, and their brain patterns are different. Identity structures are different. Perception is different. There's a great example of some research being done with Aboriginal children in Australia, where the children don't do very well when they get into school and that they're being expected to succeed within classrooms where the emphasis is on reading something and then synthesizing it and creating a synopsis and then a summary and analysis and so on. The children don't do very well at that. But if they give them very complex arrangements of objects in space and ask the children to reproduce that or to reorganize the objects in forms that are more useful, the children can do it like that. And the white children can't do that test at all. They have no idea how to organize a thing. So even as early as 7 and 8, the Aboriginal children are experts at spatial organization of objects in three-dimensional space, but they're not very good in alphabetic, linguistically based logic. The Western children are pretty good in linguistically based logic by the time they're 7 and 8, but they're hopeless at the spatial organizational skills. So we can see, and there's research like this at this point going on absolutely all over the world. So perception, motivation, what you care about. How many times have people asked you, what would you die for? If you asked people in a culture like ours, the answers tend to be very individualistic. But if you ask people in a nomadic society or a tribal society that's rooted in the land, you get very different kinds of answers. So what motivates people's lives is also influenced by the psychosphere. How you make meaning is influenced by the psychosphere. And so are the cognitive and emotional strategies that you use for dealing with the knowledge. So we've all, I think Andrew gave me a great example of that tonight on the way up. He said a friend of his went to, was it India, with the elevator?
Yes.
And he came back and told the story about going into an elevator and coming back and saying, you know, it's wonderful there. They have this thing that you can go into a room and then you stay in for a bit and then the door opens and you come out where you want to be. And that sort of sense that without the context of knowing what an elevator is and what they do and so on, it would make perfect sense that you go into the room, stay there for a bit, the door opens and you come out where you want to be. So the sense of the accumulated knowledge, the knowledge it takes to get by in life, is also part of the psychosphere. And these are just some examples of how then that results in the kind of representations of reality that are linked to the kinds of lives that people lead. So this is an example of Australian Aboriginal art, and this is art that has, it's a very embedded art. It's embedded in the space, spatial relationships, the environment. This is a sort of a kind of a map of the territory, but it's a lived experience map. It's not a conceptual map. The High Renaissance, where there was great emphasis in the High Renaissance art on individual presence, on individual beauty, individual presence, that sort of sense of I am here, which we would never have seen in an Aboriginal piece of art, which doesn't have people in it at all. Asian art, again, much more to do with space and texture and movement and rhythm. Again, not the individual ego is not present in the art. Another example, this is the kind of art that a Western scientific world produces. It's diagrams. I could show this to 80% of the people on the planet and they would not have a clue how to read this diagram. My guess is most children who have been educated in Scotland can read this kind of diagram by the time they're 14 or 15. They know what this means. It represents something real to them. 80% of the kids on the planet, it would mean nothing to them. So you have to learn how to read your world. It's not a given. The art of Southern California, of actually the young people in the West, is now a participatory art. So this is Burning Man. This is from the Burning Man Festival in California, where in fact it's a massive artwork that's produced by the 35,000 people who actually show up to do it. So it's an art piece that is there while the artists are there and disappears when they go home. Very new and different, but it speaks to the psychosphere of the times. And then one more piece here, sort of piling on the story here. Richard Nesbitt is a psychologist at Stanford who has done a lot of work on trying to map the differences between the psyches of people who are raised in Eastern societies and students who are raised in Western societies. And these are just two examples of tests that he did. The first one over here, on this side, he showed Western students and Eastern students these two drawings and asked them what they saw, these two pictures, and asked them what they saw. And the Western student said, well, I can see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 fish, there's 3 plants, there's a frog, there's a snail, there's bubbles. Essentially, what they do is they give you a calculation, they give you a numerical evaluation of what's there, and most of the things are identified as single objects. What the Asian student said is, well, it looks like a family of fish, and they're in a fish tank, and there's a kind of a community, the plants are providing the the sustenance for the fish. So what they describe is the relationship between the elements of the picture. And they emphasize the relationships. They never mention how many fish. They actually also talk about, looks like there's parents, there's big fish and little fish, so maybe that this is a family of fish. So their story of what they're seeing emphasizes the relationships, emphasizes the interrelationship between the objects. And then often at the end of the story for the Westerners, they say, well, maybe it's an aquarium. What the Asian kids very often say that first. Oh, this looks like a tank, this looks like an aquarium. They name the community before they name the individual items. And there's thousands of experiments that Nesbitt has done that confirms over and over again that a major difference between the Western way of looking at the world has a profile which is different from the Eastern way of looking at the world at a very deep level. The second graph here is he showed these showed people the first I have to do this he showed them a graph with these points on these three points. And then he asked them to put the point where he thought the next point was going to be. And the Asian students all had it coming down. Not all. I mean, statistically significant difference. And the American students all had it going up. And the more that we did these kinds of experiments, the more it becomes clear that if good times have been rolling, Americans expect them to continue. And in the Asian students, if good times have been rolling, they expect a correction. They expect a return to balance, a return back to harmony. So the expectation, even without the drawing, what do you expect to happen if three good things happen to you in a row? The American students think, well, then something else is going to be good. Not true of the Asians. They expect a correction because that's the way the universe is. It's balance. It's yin and it's yang, it's up and it's down, it's a return to harmony. So, and we don't need to go into the details of this, it's just for those who are interested, but tracking these two different kinds of responses, what Nesbitt has done is he's essentially codified the differences between the way the psyche develops within a Western psychosphere and the way the psyche develops within an Asian psychosphere. And now, of course, the real issue, the real reason I'm interested in all this is because, in fact, all of the psychospheres that any of us grew up in have all been put in the globalizing blender and somebody's pressed the button. And all of the psychospheres that have sustained our identities, whether they're Asian or European, have now been put into and they're all being dismantled as we speak and rebuilt into completely new configurations faster than any of us can think about it. And the elements of that are, you know, the population. Just reading, it was Graham was telling me today that about his one of his videos that he uses in one of his workshops, just how much information all of us have to deal with every day in comparison with how much information in a lifetime people needed to deal with 200 years ago. We are completely bombarded with information about just about anything. Could have come from anywhere in the world. We were looking at the paper today and there's a guy reading an article about a 500-year-old mummy that has a medicine bag of some kind, and the article was really about ancient 5,000-year-old people, I beg your pardon, and their medicine. So only a generation ago, ordinary people didn't know anything about medicine of any kind. They went to somebody else and so on. But now ordinary people are reading in the newspaper about the medicine habits and traditions of people who have been gone for 5,000 years. This is a phenomenal amount of information, and much of it is destabilizing of the psychospheres that most of us were born into. And so rather than that neat drawing that we had at the beginning with everything in neat concentric circles, it's more like this, that we're looking out on a world that is where everything in all these bubbles, and these are just the bubbles I put in there, you could probably put in another 50 or 60 bubbles of your own, of places where immense amounts of change in how one is in the world are going on. And that we have to somehow try and develop a coherent sense of identity, a coherent sense of meaning, a coherent sense of why bother, looking out on a world that none of us were raised to cope with. Because even the youngest among us in this room, the world has changed. When was Mosaic, the web? It was 1985. The World Wide Web, the software program that supports the World Wide Web, was not around in 1984. So that's how much the world has changed just in 25 years. So imagine how it's changed in 45 years and 60 years and 70 years, and how much it's going to change again in the next 5 years, the next 10 years. And this is unprecedented in the history of human consciousness, that change on a sustained change, this rapid, this pervasive, this deep, is going on for everybody on the planet. Add to this the realization that not only are we bombarded with information, but a great deal of it is bad news. A great deal of it is terrifying. A great deal of it is, if you go too far reading in the paper, you want to just, you know, throw it away and have a scotch. It's that hard. So many of us live, especially if we really try to engage with the world, many of us live in this kind of situation, where we're trying to navigate and negotiate this immense amount of incoherence, this immense amount of territory where there's no reliable stories that we inherited from previous generations, where we're suddenly off all of the maps that any of our systems of socialization were designed to produce. And here we are. And sort of the existential situation for all of us is similar to the crow woman who said, "I'm living in a world and a life that I don't understand." And that's true for all of us, that the kind of minds that the West has produced, and now just to speak about the Western world, this sort of world of truth, certainty, order, predictability, that is in fact an immensely successful product of the Scottish Enlightenment, that we can think in these cognitively systematic ways, unfortunately, doesn't work very well when we've got a mess this size that you have to get your arms around. And then, in fact, trying to understand this mess using those fairly limited range of cognitive and emotional and conceptual abilities may be part of the problem. So, to sort of sum up the first part of this, is that all the received psychologies are outdated. It doesn't matter whether you're in Japan or whether you're in Scotland or whether you're in Ethiopia, that whatever you received, it's out of date. And that long-held cultural and cognitive anchors are unraveling everywhere. No one is a native or ever will be. Most people are refugees, meaning that they didn't choose to be here. Culture shock and cognitive dissonance is pandemic. Bewilderment is normal and it's dangerous. We'll come back to that. Psychological and cultural coherence based in a single view of the world is now maladaptive and becomes more so. Cognitive dissonance means diminished capacity to deal with the looming problems, especially in the moral realm. And that, I think, is one of the dangers, is that when it's this complicated and there's so much cognitive dissonance and you can't get your arms around it in a nuanced way, the temptation is very strong to go for simple moral nostrums, turn the world into easy black and whites, and to reduce the incoherence by reducing what you're willing to tolerate as part of the story. Mental health is deteriorating everywhere, and this is not just a matter of, well, you know, Western psychologists are diagnosing more mental illness. This is real. This is World Health Organization that has looked everywhere. There's serious mental illness if you consider despair, not being willing to reproduce, living in terror, very high immobilizing anxiety, depression that keeps you in the house or lead you to suicide. It's that kind of mental illness that's and addictions and so on. And what the International Futures Forum, which is the group that I work with here in Glasgow and St Andrews, what we have in a sense named this as a conceptual emergency, that we do not have an adequate way to conceptualize the story that we're all now in, and that the psychospheres, that the local psychospheres, have now been disrupted to such a point that trying to regain purchase on coherence is a very difficult and often hopeless task. So I put this together in a sort of a little graph to suggest that, to sort of help myself think about this situation. And this comes out of my experience as a therapist, working both with individuals and working with groups and even working with large groups, and also as an organizational psychologist working with even with systems, that if you get enough turbulence and enough incoherence, complexity, all of the things we've been talking about, then what this generates is high anxiety. That the normal response to this level of incoherence, any kind of cognitive dissonance, that at this level of any kind of complexity of this kind is going to create cognitive dissonance, anxiety levels go very, very high. And one of the things we also know is that human beings cannot tolerate high anxiety levels for very long. We will do something to cope with it, because it's more painful than actual physical pain. So we will do something to try to resolve the anxiety. And what we know as therapists is that there's more than one possible response to high anxiety. That one of the responses is to just throw up your hands, break down completely, disintegrate, often violently, acting out on others, acting out on oneself, just an incoherent, violent response, unconnected to reality, and we would call that a psychotic response. That sometimes anxiety gets so high that nothing is making any sense, and we would call that a psychotic response. Another response is to try desperately to get things under control and to not allow the anxiety to get out of control, and we wouldn't call that a neurotic response. And the other response, which we'll get to, is there is a possibility in those moments, though, that if the circumstances are adequate, if the conditions are such that a person can be held or a group can hold itself in that situation of anxiety and live through it, that not only does it get beyond it, but often to higher levels of integration, to higher levels of capacity, that you would call a growth step or an aha moment or an existential leap into some newer and bigger sense of capacity. And so I'm interested in sort of looking at this mess of what's going on called our culture, our world, and trying to identify which of the responses can we see out there that would fall into each of these categories. And I think it's fairly clear that there's a whole lot of neurotic responses going on, that there's lots of them and us. There's lots of win-lose games. There's lots of competing stories, you know, whose story is better. We focus on boundaries. Immigration rules get tighter. We don't want those foreigners here. And we simplify. We try to put things in boxes. We quantify. We have accountability movements. We have all kinds of methods to somehow simplify, control, make sure it doesn't get too chaotic, keep it all neatly in a box. And I bet you every single one of you sitting in this room today lives in some part of the world that is doing this, that is trying to somehow control the chaos by organizing it, controlling it, quantifying it, labeling it, counting it. Every single one of you lives in some kind of... Because it's part of how this culture, your culture and American culture, is actually trying to cope with the transformation, is by not letting it happen. Fundamentalisms of all kinds, scientific fundamentalism, religious fundamentalism. There's all kinds of fundamentalisms where one true one right answer, one true path, one true solution to any problem. I'm calling these fundamentalisms. And fragmentation, well, we won't deal with each other. We'll fragment. We don't have to deal with the Serbs and the Bosnians. We can separate them so that we don't have to deal with them. And so these are all defensive mechanisms to try to somehow avoid the complexity of the world that we're in. And it's perfectly understandable, it's normal, and it's okay temporarily, but if you do this long enough, you'll end up with a system that's got, has so much of its energy invested in the defense against the chaos, that it doesn't have any energy for creativity, for novelty, for growth, for innovation. And so the price you pay for this strategy is in innovation, is in freedom, is in exuberance, is in play, is in spontaneity, and so on. These are all very natural responses, but as I say, the price you pay for these are very high. As with an individual, the neurosis protects the person from their worst fears, but the price they pay is paralyzing their lives. And the same is with groups and with organizations and systems, and I'm arguing that's true for societies as well. The chaotic response is nihilism, it's lose-lose games, it's the Rwandan situations, it's the breakdown of former Yugoslavia, it's that there's no solidarity at all, there's no boundaries at all. We see situations like this in failed states. This is going on in Haiti. There are whole societies where there are no structures at all. And I would call this the chaotic response. So back to Havel. Without a global revolution in the sphere of human consciousness, nothing will change for the better. And so the question, and I agree with him, because I think the situation, from our analysis of it, there are not, if you look just at the surface of all the demographics and the metrics that we ordinarily look to ask ourselves how healthy are we, the news is pretty grim. But if you remember that in any crisis of consciousness, there's always the possibility of a transformational response, then there's another response to that information. And that response is maybe the information about how bad everything is telling us just how much anxiety there is, how painful, how our situation is so overwhelming and can't be sustained in this space. But maybe if we take the learnings that we have from systems and from individuals, we should be looking for the transformational responses rather than settling for the neurotic or the chaotic. And the tendency, of course, is for all of us when we're this terrified is to hunker down and hope it goes away and say, well, at least I'm going to get through this. It's not to look for the transformational possibilities. But I would argue that there actually are real signs of hope, that there are places you can look. In the International Futures Forum, we were dealing with the dark side of the story, the chaotic and the neurotic side of the story. And our Indian colleague, Arun Myra, said, you know, if you want to see signs of hope, you might want to look in places where you wouldn't expect to look, like India, for example. And we said, well, you know, most of us understood that something big was going on in India because Indians were getting into the electronic world and so on. No, he said, that's not where I want to take you. So I want to take you to some of the slums. I want to take you to the places where people have nothing. I want to take you to places where all of the elements of the chaos would be there. And I want to show you that there is another response. And so we all went to India, and sure enough, we were exposed to signs of hope. And just a quick story is that the metaphor that struck us most strongly in the Indian encounter was that a group of Indian people getting ready for the World Economic Forum meeting in Davos about 4 years ago had come up with four scenarios for the future of India. And one of those scenarios they called Tigers Marauding, and that was a scenario where all the wealth of India would essentially be eaten away by the West and by people who would strip the bones off the Indian tiger and leave it, take their money and run, essentially. And another one was, another scenario was, they called it peacock's preening, and this was like the Bollywood scenario where very wealthy people, the trickle-down scenario where very wealthy people would feed off the global riches and trickle down something to the poor. But so that's how the poor people in India would get beyond their situation. Another one was buffaloes wallowing, and this was essentially that the large bureaucracies and the large institutions, which were pretty much paralyzed anyway, would continue to wallow and continue to promise to the people that one day we'll get the health service together, one day we'll get food service together, but the people would go on waiting. And the scenario that got all of our attention was that they called fireflies rising. And fireflies rising was a scenario where hundreds of thousands of small NGOs, people who were working with 5, 10, 15 other people, were getting together and with very, very little resources beyond their own energy and their own hope and their own sense of the future, were getting together and beginning to change some of the conditions of life that ordinary people were faced with in a way that would left them feeling that life had coherence, that life had meaning, life had joy, life had pleasure, and that their children, that they had hope for the future. And so in the signs of hope can be in places that you don't expect to see them. That there are also socializing processes for new kinds of minds. I can get very depressed about the American educational system that seems to produce people who can think in, can only think using a PowerPoint presentation, and they think in bullet points. But there are other places where people go for socialization. They go to mostly outside the formal educational systems. They go to yoga centers. They go to retreats. They go on Outward Bound. They have workplace training. They have change management activities. They're working with video games. All of these activities are actually, in a sense, creating a new psychosphere. They're creating new elements in which new minds for new times are emerging. And the more you look for these, the more you'll see them. You'll see them all over the place. You'll see them in art centers. You'll see them in local training centers. You'll see them in the transition town movements. You'll see them in India. You'll see them in the social entrepreneurs, the social innovators movements. So all over the world, there are millions of very small groups of people who actually have recognized that we are in a new world, that we are in new times, that we will need a new way to think about who we are and what we owe each other. And what we owe the planet. And although it's off the radar for the most part, the major newspapers don't cover this at all. In fact, if you spend just a little time noodling around, you'll find out that there's a whole groundswell underneath the radar screen of innovations that really suggest that there's a new consciousness developing. And for me, one of the best proofs that this is actually going on was the election of Obama in the American election last month. That what this represents, the people who didn't vote for Obama are the people over 60 and mostly people who were fairly comfortable. And what the who did vote for him were people who have understood that this is a new world, that the old rules are not going to work, and that what we're looking at is a world that has to reconcile opposites in a way that the West has not had to do before, that has to reconcile the fact that he's black and he's not black, he's white and he's not white, he's a leader but he's really not. And there's many, and I don't have time to go into the whole, all of the different things that I heard from my students. During the election, I was doing an online class, and I was asking students, why is this person so interesting to you? And I had students who were 18, and I had students who were 50, because this is a university that attracts people of all different ages, had students who were on active duty in Iraq, in the Marine Corps who would take online classes and just to keep sane. I had students who were Mormons from Utah. This is a very diverse student body. And what they were talking about was that they recognized something in the way he talks about things and about people that seemed to suggest that he's working with a consciousness that's more nuanced, that's more balanced between what we would call the Western way of thinking and the Eastern way of thinking. Not that he's got much in the way of contact with the East, but he understands yoga and Tai Chi, and he's allowed himself to, as his generation in general, this is not just about him. I said to my friend Graham on the way in, I don't think the issue about the transformation is in Obama. It's in what has happened to America in the last 40 years that an Obama could be elected president with the kind of majority and the kind of cross the board acceptance in America that he's got. It's what's happened in the psychosphere that has allowed someone like him to be seen as a future an American president. And lots of work has had to happen for this to occur. Students in high schools and colleges and elementary schools have been doing race relations work. They've been doing diversity work. They've been doing multicultural dance groups. America has, since the 60s, made a concerted effort to say, we're a multicultural society. We better learn how to be that, because the alternative is pretty awful. And so I would suggest and that what we're seeing is essentially the culmination, not of a good campaign manager, but the culmination of 40 or 50 years of work at the level of changing the consciousness and changing the psychosphere, so that now, instead of this man being seen as other, he's just seen as one of us, and a pretty smart one at that. And that kind of cultural shift, I think, is going to be necessary, not just at the level of who's the leader, but it's going to be necessary at the level of almost every problem that we have to face. And what my interest is how do we get to a new consciousness? What is it taking? Where we've seen new consciousness emerge, where does it seem to be coming from? It doesn't seem to be coming from the big industrialized universities. It doesn't seem to be coming from the big industrialized companies. It seems to be coming from the margins, from the artists, from the people who challenge the system, people who have been left out and have, in a sense, not been so well socialized into the mainstream that they can still see the world from an alternative point of view. It seems to be coming from the transgressive acts, not aggressive, transgressive acts, the people who say, we can do this differently. And the whole blogosphere is a space in which those kinds of transgressive relationships are everywhere, where the psychosphere of the blogosphere is different enough that people are inventing new relational forms, new ways to be together, which essentially translates back into a new way of socializing the minds that have to live in this world. And so what we're seeing, I think, and in there's very little research on this, but there is a little, is that what's happening is we're seeing a kind of a hybrid psychology emerge. A lot of these hybrid psychologies are seen often in immigrant groups, people who have actually had to navigate more than one worldview, more than one system, people who have been colonized, who've had to navigate both their indigenous psychosphere and the one that came in. So they've learned to live, they're developing a hybrid psychology. And this side is what I would say is the psychology or the psyche that is aimed at in Western education, rational, focused, exclusive, clear boundaries, objectivist, and so on. And emerging is an interest in intuitive, extra-rational. There's a lot of interest in the mystical, and people can laugh at and do at the New Age movement. But if you think about what the New Age movement is, it's really kind of a response to hyper-rationalism that has been part of our major psychosphere. We're learning how to see things holistically rather than just analytically and reductionistically. We're learning how to do the wide-angle, big-picture stuff, cross different disciplines. We're learning how to see similarities rather than differences. We're learning to live with fluid boundaries rather than fixed boundaries. Much more emphasis on relationality. We're looking at patterns of the whole rather than analytical parts of the whole. We're much more interested in community groups. There's a resurgence in the States of community involvement of all different kinds. People who used to live in their nice little one single bed, single family homes are getting together and becoming communities that actually care for each other and actually are responsive to each other. Interest in the synthetic, the poetic, the imaginal is beginning to reassert itself in society, whether it's in fantastical video games and so on. On the one hand, you can see this stuff as debased. On the other hand, you can see this as, oh no, wait a minute, this is a place where I can learn to integrate the mythic with the poetic, with the imaginal, with the analytical, with the objectivist, with the strategic. And a good video game will do all of that. The final thing is that we need to have a psyche that is certain enough to act. We don't want people who are sitting cross-legged on the floor saying it is what it is. But you have to be certain to act. But you also have to be uncertain enough to learn. And we have not created an educational system in the West that's emphasized that to learn means to not know, means to be willing to live in the space of uncertainty. And that there's nothing wrong with being uncertain. It's actually a precursor to learning something new. And I think that I'm putting together research from a lot of different places, but I think this is not a big jump to say we are seeing in the people who are interested in getting back engaged with Obama's politics, getting back engaged with their communities, getting back engaged with the ecology movement, with new spirituality, new forms of spirituality, a lot of interest in deep cross-cultural encounters, not the kind of, you know, month abroad kind of cross-cultural encounters. Kids going to live in tribal areas for 2 years and really immersing themselves in a completely different way of life. There's more and more of that is going on. So my hope, in a sense, is that this is a real shift, that we do have reasons to hope, that we do have reasons to believe that the people on the vanguard, and many of them are young, and are people who in some ways are not, they're not fazed at all by the incoherence, because for them it's not incoherent. It is the world. And it's a world that is interpretable through the lens of a hybrid psychology. And I will just sort of finish up here with this, why my investment is in changing schools, whether they're elementary schools or whether they're universities and everything in between, that in order for us to really face the world as it is and not the world that was when our 19th century educational system was created, schools will have to change, not just a little reform on the edges, but profound reorganization of how young people learn, how middle-aged people learn, how old people learn. There's no point in emphasizing content in schools anymore. I have fights with my colleagues at the university all the time who will say, well, you know, the importance of the curriculum is they've got to master the subject matter. And my answer to that is, well, subject matter up to when? Because if we have, by the time this report is finished, the subject matter will have likely changed. In most of the fields that the young folks who come to my university are interested in, the changes are happening so fast that the textbooks are out of date before the second edition. So we don't have second editions anymore, we have a new textbook. So content has to become less important, and process, learning how ideas flow, how ideas go together, the sort of the different cognitive processes that go into learning, has to become more the focus. We need pedagogies that are experiential, that involve the whole person and not just some kind of abstraction of the frontal cortex. We need more modes of inquiry. Many of the things that we have to solve, many of the problems that we have to tackle, we have to engage with, are not going to yield to analytical methods that rely on sophisticated statistics. For the most part, we're in the mess. We're in the middle of things. So we need research methods that can actually handle the complexity of the situations that we're in. I don't know about in this country, but in the United States, qualitative research is always seen as inferior. It's always seen as less valuable than the big statistical analysis that you do for your dissertation. That's changing, because people are recognizing that there really isn't a nice analytical model to deal with the healthcare system. This is a human system, and human systems are different. Human systems have values in them, they have qualities in them, they have nuance, they have relationships, they have politics, have dynamics. And you can't reduce that to a series of bar graphs. And we've tried to do that for 50 years or more, and we have made a mess of many of the large systems because we've left the really important stuff out, which is who we are as human beings. We need an open system. Okay, there's some repetition here, but we have to focus on things like information literacy, visual communication, bricolage, putting things together from other places. It's a very interesting issue around, this comes up in America, about plagiarism, because students will put together an article and a paper, and they'll bring stuff from all over the place. They've got the web, they've got the whole wide world out there, and they'll put it together and weave it together and make a paper that's powerful, that makes a statement, and really says something new, except that it's pieced together from work that they didn't do. Is this plagiarism? Is this not plagiarism? Those kinds of rules will have to be re-examined, because it's not, it's changing underneath our, as we stand. We need a globalized curriculum. We all of our curriculum, I don't care whether you're in India or whether you're in San Diego, our curriculum is way too local for the kind of world even the next few years we have to deal with, let alone 20, 25 years. And if you think about a child in school at 5, by the time they're an adult and working in the world, we're talking about 20 years later. Think of how much the world has changed in the last 20 years. And imagine how the world will change in the next 20 years. Is what our kids are learning in school what they're going to need for 20 years from now? And the answer, I think, is that we don't know. So if we can't predict the world as it's going to be in 20 years, we can predict that they're going to need to make room for love, for their emotions, for their spirituality, for aesthetics. We can predict that they're going to be working in a globalized world. And we can predict that it's going to be important for them to understand not only the short term, but also the medium and the long term future. And we need, obviously, new organizational forms. This is a very hot issue in the academy. The university, which is pretty much my ecological niche, is an 800-year-old institution. And it hasn't changed much in 800 years. And when you think about it, the disciplinary boundaries are not that different from what they were in Siena in the 1300s. And that cannot survive the world that we now have. And yet the fights in academia are over disciplinary boundaries. And whether this department gets a new position or this department gets a new division, and God forbid you should try to hire somebody who could work in both departments, because we don't have people who work in two departments. And this is my university. I don't know what it's like over here. So we really need to socialize in new minds for new times. The socializing institutions, which include the universities and include the high schools and include the elementary schools, will have to change fundamentally, because they're designed in a psychosphere that no longer exists and for a psychosphere that no longer exists. And the psychosphere that they have to function in, we don't know what the parameters are of that. So we have to be producing people who are okay in worlds of uncertainty, who are not paralyzed by not knowing what comes next. People who can figure it out as they go along, who are improvisers, who are innovators, who are people who, instead of seeing instability as a problem, see it as, oh, this is cool. I mean, my son, he got very wet a lot of times learning to surf. But once he learned to surf, that was just, there's no problem with this wave, there's no problem with this turbulence, you can learn to surf it. And I see more and more people coming into my university who are learning to surf it and are not threatened by it, but actually it is their native language. So, in conclusion, my thesis is that we don't have any choice about this, actually, that we are entering the 21st century, but as immigrants, because it's different from the world that we were born into. We now live as strangers in a strange land. And to pretend that we know our way around is a neurotic response. To throw your hands up and say, to hell with it, I'm going to get drunk, is a psychotic response. But the transformational response is, what do we need to sustain ourselves in these kinds of times so that we can become more than we are, which essentially is a growth step, it's an evolutionary step. And is this a moment in history? Is this a change of eras? And if it is a change of era, are we up for the task of social learning? And just so that you know, we've done it before. So we know we can do this. When we went from the agrarian world to the industrial world, we had to do it then. We changed our educational system, we changed our local parish systems, we changed people's daily life, we even changed our architecture. We changed all of the elements of the psychosphere to produce people who would be at home in the industrialized world. We've done it before, we know how to do it. We don't know what to do for this situation, but neither did our ancestors. They just knew that something new was going to be needed. And they didn't shrink from the task of saying, this is not a moment for tinkering at the edges. This is a radical shift that we either make it into a growth mode or we will be buried by it. And my fear is, and I'll be blunt with you, is I'm not sure if enough of us are up for it. And I'm not sure if enough of our leaders are up for it. Because our leaders tend to be saying, let's hunker down, let's keep doing more of the same. And most of you know the old joke about the definition of insanity is you keep on doing the same old thing over and over again even after you figured out it doesn't work. And that, in a sense, I'm concerned that the inertia of the large-scale institutions, political institutions, educational institutions, religious institutions, social institutions, are caught up in a neurotic response to the chaos and the turbulence and the threatened disintegration, and have not yet seen it as an opportunity to flip into that new understanding. Not that any of none of us know what it needs to be, but we've got some inklings because we can look at the people who are succeeding. We look at the people who are doing okay. There are exemplars of people and communities that are so. So what I'm really saying is that, and really appreciate the opportunity to share these ideas with you guys tonight, is that I am not sure that our leaders will have the, whatever you want to call them, to actually seize the transformational path here, but will be more likely to go for the safe path, which in my view is ultimately a suicide path, because I don't think we get there through here. We need a shift, as Vaclav Havel said, we need a transformation in consciousness if we're to avoid the catastrophe to which we seem to be heading. So thank you.
Thank you, Maureen. I see some people are heading for the exit. So that's a powerful story and quite a challenging one, and I've heard it a few times before and can let you know that it will take some time to absorb. I can also let you know that the framing of the psychotic, the neurotic, and the transformational responses to anxiety is actually quite useful. And it's not as difficult as Maury makes it sound, because we are allowed to show all three.
Yes.
And actually it is a 21st century competence to recognise when you're in each mode. So I'm fond of going home now and saying I'm afraid I need a psychotic evening after that. But at least, you know, at least I regard that as progress to recognise when you need, you know, how you're managing your anxiety. I thought the other signs of hope in what Maureen was saying that I want to pick up on before we get into a discussion. In any crisis of consciousness, there is always the possibility of a transformational response. Sounded very hopeful to me. The Obama story, framed as Obama's election as a result, actually, of 40 years of hard work in beginning to transform the psychosphere, is a hopeful story. And I was particularly struck by your question, where does the new consciousness come from? Where do we look for it? You know, we look for the fireflies, we look at the margins, we look at the transgressors, not the aggressors. We look in unexpected places. And I think that's one of the links into the whole story of the Glasgow Centre for Population Health. You know, where should we be looking in Glasgow and Scotland for those signs of hope and the signs of the transformational response? We've got about 15 minutes before we get into a more relational context next door. But in this context, which has been set up for us, normally we'd have questions and answers, but I think actually what I'd like to hear, and I'm sure what Maureen would like to hear, are just some reactions and some reflections and some thoughts that presentation has provoked that will lead into a discussion that will continue or maybe even just begin next door. So what's that stirred up?
Using terms such as stability and uncertainty, and I kind of feeling that they're very value laden. That we want to have stability, we want to have certainty. It struck me, I had to do some interviews with staff on my work. Everyone's saying things are uncertain, it's really bad, it's a really difficult place to work, instability, we don't know what's happening, it's very, very difficult. Clearly, people are telling me they don't want to work, they don't like instability, they don't like uncertainty. But actually look at what people have been doing in terms of their reaction to it. Some of the best work which they've done to try and understand what it is that we're doing and to make sense of it has happened in that context. So I've got this paradox. Yeah. I've got a work environment that people don't like. They don't want to be in it, but the reaction to it is very, very good. So when you're using terms of instability and uncertainty and saying they're good, are we making too much of them? Are we actually undervaluing the way people can respond to those kinds of difficult circumstances?
Can we just take this?
Yeah, okay, yeah.
We need as much complexity as possible.
Okay, thanks, Graham.
Yeah, my response is two things. One, you've given an example here with Barack Obama and his election. And it's against my principles to take away the positive element of that. But to be honest, if the markets hadn't melted down, I, for one, wonder whether Barack Obama would have been elected. Because, and I think that to give a summation of where we are today, psychologically, economically, etc., in the world, not talk about the impact of neoliberal values, the value system over the last sort of 20, 25, 30 years, is, you know, to miss a huge point, because, you know, the impacts of the IMF, the World Bank, all those policies, and that's the world we have now, and it has melted down. That nightmare was always going to come to this conclusion, and now you see that madness exactly played out as you're talking about it, where people are saying, well, people just got to get spending in, people have just got to, you know, things have got to get back to how they were. You know, it couldn't be any more bloody clear that if things go back to the way they were, we are heading, you know, right down that negative path that you've lined out. And you're right, I think, in terms of the leadership, with maybe some honourable exceptions across the world do not have the wisdom, let's put it that way, to take those paths. And there's been some fantastic seminars before this, A.C. Grayling and Reuben Nelson in particular, I think. And if we take some of the knowledge they brought here and looking at the need for the saviours to become from the grassroots, not to come from where the status quo, the people who are comfortable, who have benefited from the meltdown of the world. Yeah. We do have to look, the examples of the ladies in India who reacted to the genetic programming of seeds to say, you know, we're not going to do this, we are going to. There's some fantastic, in a documentary called Company, I don't know if you've seen that, there's fantastic examples in there. But I think it's the personal responsibility, what I take away from this talk, and I would think we all need to take away from that, it's a personal responsibility that we all have for this window of opportunity that we face now. If we miss it, you know, any kind of turn back is going to be virtually impossible.
Yeah.
And it's like, how do we all work together, collectively and individually, to grasp the opportunity we have now, which we're unlikely to see again if we don't act right now.
Yeah.
And in uncomfortable workplaces.
Yeah, I just want, my response to both is that I completely agree with both of you. I think that part of what I'm trying to do, the instability and insecurity is the existential, that's the experience that people have. They feel uncertain and they feel unstable. But as I say, there's nobody less stable than a surfer, but they actually don't experience it as scary. They experience it as thrilling. But you have to learn that. There's a certain mastery of being able to handle those kinds of situations, feeling safe enough to enjoy it. And that reframe from taking it from an aversive situation to an invitation to thrill, I think that's actually one of the cultural pieces of work that we have to do. Because I think, you know, a lot of this people think uncertainty is always a negative thing, and yet you can't really learn if you're not uncertain. So I think that some of the psychosphere that we inhabit describes this butterfly fluttery feeling as insecurity, when it may just be right on the edge of excitement and thrill. But and therapists do that all the time, of course, with their clients. One of the ways you can help a client deal with their anxiety is to have them relabel it as, oh my God, it maybe it's excitement. So there's a piece of cultural leadership needed to reframe, because you're right. Most artists that take a big leap will, you know, beads of sweat, blood comes out of their forehead before they actually make the breakthrough, but they wouldn't not do it because the experience of what comes after it is satisfying in itself. How do we get that sense of the art that the artist gets to ordinary people in a world that's told ordinary people that their creative moments are not relevant and not important, that they're so... There's stuff in there that we could talk about a lot, and I completely agree with you. And then in this, the situation that you're talking about, I think that the neoliberal myth of the marketplace is an enormous element in the Western psychosphere that has created, that has got us to the point where we're out of touch. We've been out of touch with the energetic realities of life for quite some time. We've been able to survive it because we've had the rest of the world to exploit. But now in a global environment, we no longer do. So now the issue is, what do we do with this moment? So I agree with, and back about the Obama situation, I'm not sure whether he would have gotten elected or not. I just know that he did. And I could imagine, couldn't we all have imagined, that at a time of that kind of chaos and terror in the American society, they might have actually gone for Daddy McCain, somebody who was older and wiser and more solid and so on, but they didn't. They went for somebody who they felt, they said, seemed to be more focused towards the future. So you could spin that and say it's actually rather remarkable that as the meltdown occurred, they actually went for the riskier of the two candidates, the outsider. But I don't want to make too much of that, because I actually was trying to make the point of what's happened inside the American culture. There is a large number of people who would listen to something that you just said and say, I completely agree with you, brother. We're ready for that change. I'm not sure whether it will happen or not, because as I said, I'm not sure that the leadership will dare. And I think that means that what we'll see in the next few months, when Obama actually takes over, can he bring the people along with him to any kind of radical transformation of the economic realities of Western capitalism? Does he have a mandate to do that? Probably not. But if situation gets bad enough, he may get that mandate. And I think the window is very small for him. In terms of the transformational agenda for us, I'm not sure whether the window's small or big, but I know we have to go through it. It doesn't matter whether we have to do it now, and all of the different ways in which people are taking initiative is an encouragement to me, and I hand that on and say, and that's my only faith. It is that local people doing local things for themselves and for their people that they care about, with the expectation that eventually enough drops of water and we end up with something we can drink. And so I'm not Reuben Nelson is a very good friend of mine, and we spend hours and hours and hours and hours and hours and years together, and he and I talk about this stuff a lot. And we don't know whether we'll actually take this moment and be creative with it, or whether we will just piss it away like we have done before. I don't know.
I'm going to take three more comments. Gentleman at the back, lady in the middle here, and gentleman at the front. A couple of things. First of all, this concept of the ecosphere. What's the difference between psychosphere and culture? Is that term might, be invoked by, cross-cultural psychology?
Yeah.
I'm struggling to...
It links up the inner psychological world with the outer world. And culture, as I understand it, talks more about over explicit and symbolic representational world, and doesn't talk much about the inner psychological landscape. So that's all. That's.
I'm thinking, I don't want to go on at this point for too long, but I'm thinking that the cultural historical psychology associated with, like, for Mike Cole, who is in San Diego,
which
uses the concept of culture in precisely that way.
Right.
Drawn under the Vygotskian tradition. So I found that I'm struggling to sort out the concepts here a lot, but sometimes you invoke the idea of culture in a different way from you were talking about psychosphere, and sometimes you seem to use them as synonyms.
Yeah.
The thing that was troubling me more was that I thought I'd understood you, and when you responded to this question here, I no longer know if I do. Because in some ways you seem to me to be saying that what we were looking for was a solution to a problem of profound cognitive dissonance, if you boil it down to that.
Right.
But then the response to this question seemed to suggest that, that in a sense, dissonance with the new consonance, if we can only learn how to suck.
No.
I just want to take two more comments, because we're going to have
He's
to
He's the chairman,
very
I have to...
quickly.
Order is order.
Order is order. More comments, and then you will wrap all of this up into one even more confusing answer.
I'm not an eminent anybody. I was just talking to the health service, but last week Professor Abner was talking about leaders, like government should target unhappiness, and I've been doing a short course on positive psychology, Seligman's work, and I was sitting there thinking to myself where the tie-up between what you're saying about us being in total disarray and chaos, etc. Surely there's a tie-up there that what the government is doing in regards to finance, etc., people's house being repossessed, they're trying to target that unhappiness by looking at trying to stabilize things like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, so people feel secure. And at base level, they feel secure. They haven't got self-actualization, but they feel secure. So therefore, should we not then be introducing positive psychology and telling people about this concept of this is where we are now? Because I think a lot of people don't understand this is where we are, and we're no longer in that old paradigm, and that if you start thinking about being grateful for the fact that that your house isn't going to be repossessed, that government is helping you, then actually people can start then taking gratitudes and believing, well, this is the world we're now in, and then this concept that you've just given us, and they understand this, then they will start being innovative and start thinking out of the box and say, yeah, well, now maybe we do need to rethink where we are, and we'll understand that this is where I think positive psychology actually is the vehicle to getting to where you are, and for us to understand where we are and our insecurities. Because talking to people at work, it's true, people are feeling insecure. They're not sure when they think about career pathways, what they're going to be doing or where they're going. And therefore, what I'm trying to say is, I do think the leaders have a duty to try and stabilise, but equally, try and bring in some positive psychology to people, the population at large, and say, actually, you know, things, there is a positive and positive optimism, if you like. And it's never going to be, at the moment, as great as it was, and we're not going to even actually have material things like we did, the majority. However, we can learn different ways of life and different sort of aspects of life, like spirituality. I'm not religious, but, you know, we can understand the world better and be more in touch. I don't know. Maybe people don't understand where I'm coming from, but I just think that what you're saying is brilliant. People need to understand that's where we are. I'm not so sure that most people out there understand where we are at all. I think we're all at sea.
One final comment.
Yeah, Maureen, things were going very well until you suggested that globalisation of the curriculum would be a good thing. I felt really that that was the antithesis of so many of the other good things, the good things that you've said. For example, you started right at the beginning with the notion that the Indians had their local curriculum, which was very good and worked in their situation. And I would be very worried that the curriculum that we have in communities and the creativity that arises would be lost with that globalisation.
That's very fair. And in fact, I usually say globalise and localise. Right. So, very fair. Yes, I see positive psychology as a response to the predicament. And it's one of the signs of hope. It's one of the places where people are going for approaching that is geared towards not buckling under in despair, but staying alert to opportunities. I have some problems with it ultimately, and this is not the night for that, but. My own orientation, which is Rogerian, it's humanistic, really trusts the intrinsic capacity for self-renewal in whatever form you can find it, rather than to sort of present a positive frame on things. You know, there's some people actually do better when they're kind of depressed. And that, you know, you tell them to cheer up and they go away. I know what I'm doing and I'll do it my way. So positive psychology works for people that positive psychology works for. That's cool. So I think, yes, and I see it. When I see Martin Seligman, who I know, standing up and saying positive psychology will improve the world, he's probably right. When he says it's a panacea for everybody, he's probably wrong. But that doesn't matter. Doesn't make it bad. So... But what you said is very important about if it shifts someone's frame so that they're alert to the opportunities to be creative, then I don't care how somebody gets there. That's where we want people to be. And depression makes you not responsive to any opportunities. So if it helps people have their all their capacities available to them to respond to the situation, rather than to feel overwhelmed and so on. Anything that we do is good. I mean, a good movie, a birthday card from your mother. I mean, and I'm not saying this to trivialize it. That you were saying, what can we do for each other as a community? One of the things we can do for each other as a community is to be nice to each other. You know, to say nice things to each other. I know that sounds really trite, but we don't do it nearly enough. we think it's okay. It's how the Enlightenment heritage is criticism, the culture of criticism, and that you'll arrive at truth by attacking each other's ideas. No, you don't. I mean, so it sounds really trite, but there's culturally, you probably all know about the, I've got a block on it now, Bhutan, the kingdom of Bhutan. They have a happiness policy. The whole country believes in doing everything and honoring everything and reinforcing everything that makes people feel happy. And sure enough, you go to Bhutan and everybody's smiling, everybody will tell you that they love life. They've got so much less than we do. So there are, in that sense, each person is a culture maker, whether it's just in your own family or whether it's in your neighborhood or whether it's in a letter to the editor. But we have somebody's got to start being nice and start being hopeful and stop, I mean, at least add to the possibility talk and not only to the ain't it awful talk. And I think that's what you're talking about, is possibility talk. And I completely support that. I think that's, I like it a lot better when people say, hey, it's really good to see you, Maureen, and instead of, where the hell have you been for the last month? So, trivial little piece, but what you're saying is not trivial. It's very important.
Well, we're going to have to pull a halt there. Before we go next door, to start being nice to each other. Or even nice.
Not going to be nice to you, Greg.
We'll be even nicer to each other. So I'd just like us to put our heads together and thank Maureen for introducing so much possibility for us.
Do you want me to give you I'll give you the DVD and a short file on your memory stick before I take it out.
To do what?
I've got a copy of it. I'll just put it on.
Well, were you cut? Were you?
No. I'm going to do it. The English version of that DVD. The English version of the Glasgow DVD. Anyone here?
Okay.
If you want to play it when you get back home, speak to the camera. I'll send you a copy. Just when you're on the same piece. Okay.
Huh? Only a few people left.
One of the things that Ruben says in his top work is, if we think that liberal democracy capitalism is going to make it far into the 21st century, we're a completely different country.
There's part of us saying, one of the things standing on it, for people who come to see it, you know, the whole thing is scattered, but you know, the method of the madness, the first budget was just get after offer.
Yeah.
So when the public was Mr. John Patton, the true